Sumner Erickson was introduced to the tuba in sixth grade. He had hoped to learn to play the trumpet, but a tuba was the only instrument available. This accidental pairing of musician and instrument led to a long career as tuba player in the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Sumner joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his new book, Actors of Sound.
I'm there, 18 years old. They had just told the seven people in the finals that they had selected this 18-year-old kid to be the tuba player of the Pittsburgh Symphony. So they pull me in an office and they offer me a contract. And the manager looks at me, the assistant manager, he goes, "You ever been to Europe?" I'm like, "No." He says, "We're going next spring." And the first stop was Bonn, Germany. And the first stop in Bonn, Germany was Beethoven's birthplace. I mean, it was just, you know, how amazing to get to have those experiences and repeatedly go back to Europe. And we did seven tours of Japan and been, and we played China. We went to Russia. We went to Poland. It's been, we always had to go to big enough places that could bring in a concert, a symphony orchestra, full symphony orchestra. So we didn't go to the littler places often, but, you know, been on the beach in Rio, on the wall in China, in the Kremlin, in Red Square.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast featuring me, John Lipkoski. One of your co-hosts, the other co-host being Scoop Sweeney, my partner here, and Wendy Grossman, who is our persistent co-host and who contributes a lot to the conversations. And today we're joined by a very cool guest, musician Sumner Erickson, a virtuoso, classically trained tubist. Sumner has spent much of his life pushing the boundaries of music, really, performing with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, exploring jazz and experimental sounds, doing various musical projects and collaborations. And he's not only an accomplished performer, but also a creative force who blends tradition with innovation. And he's always seeking new ways to connect through music. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about Sumner's new book, Actors of Sound. It's a book about making music, and it's more broadly applicable to how we live and how we create. Is that a good intro?
Thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege to be here,
everyone. Yeah, we're so happy to have you here. I really enjoyed reading the book.
Wonderful. I'm honored. Thank you.
And I guess my first, that's kind of an obvious question. How did you choose the tuba as your instrument, and how did you get into the Pittsburgh Symphony? What was it like working with Andre Previn?
Well, the tuba kind of chose me. It wasn't my first choice, and my dad was literally between checks in his private architecture and engineering practice, and I was a fifth born child, and I said, "I need a trumpet," and for whatever reason, trumpet wasn't available in sixth grade, so they put me on a school-owned instrument, the tenor tuba, otherwise called baritone or euphonium. And then I played that for a year, and Dad hadn't come back and said, you know, "Let's get the trumpet." And then I started going into seventh grade, and I questioned them. I'm like, "What can I do with this thing, this tenor tuba, euphonium?" They said, "Well, you can play in a military band, maybe some jazz." And they were trying to recruit me on the tuba at that school in seventh grade, with Verna Covington and Porter Junior High. And so I said, "What can I do with the tuba?" They said, "Well, you can do military, some jazz, or symphony orchestra." So me going into seventh grade, I thought I better broaden my horizons. So I went to the tuba thinking, of course, I could play that in more. And then was enormously blessed to have a great leader, teacher, crew in Austin High. And then beat over 20 people and became the only tuba player in the Curtis Institute, which is a free, great music conservatory in Philadelphia. If you get in, it's free, but they only have one at every time. And then just months later in February, and I'm still 18 years old, I beat over 100 people in Pittsburgh. And Andre Previn said, "I don't care if he's eight, he's my tuba player."
So what made you decide to audition for the Pittsburgh Symphony?
Well, my mother's a classically trained singer, And she was always practicing around the house as, one great way to expose us. And then often she'd need us to go on a Saturday movie run while she listened to the opera broadcast, I think, on the Met on Saturdays, if my memories are serving a little bit. So growing up in the church choir, there was just always an interest in classical music. My dad's rock and roll was jazz and Tommy Dorsey and that kind of stuff. And then as a tuba player, if I really thought I was going to go into music, there wasn't a lot of choices. I did not want to be in a military band. It didn't seem like an option I wanted. And so symphony orchestra sounded like a great option, but I was completely naive to sort of how big the job was once you have one of those. And then also how rare it is to actually have one of those, beating over 100 people at an audition is not a everyday occurrence. For me, it wasn't. I only won one big job. Subsequently, I auditioned in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Boston. And I feel like I did my part at those auditions where I played to my satisfaction, but they didn't want me. And so I get to go back to Pittsburgh. And it was a great, great career there. I was blessed to have it.
And you traveled all over the world with that, right?
Yes. If we'd have known each other then, if you asked me about the job, I'd say the tours, countless times to Europe. I don't even know, dozens and dozens. I'm there 18 years old. They had just told the seven people in the finals that they had selected this 18-year-old kid to be the tuba player of the Pittsburgh Symphony. And so they pull me in an office and they offer me a contract. And the manager looks at me, the assistant manager, he goes, "You ever been to Europe?" I'm like, "No." He says, "We're going next spring." And the first stop was Bonn, Germany. And the first stop in Bonn, Germany was Beethoven's birthplace. I mean, it was just, how amazing to get to have those experiences and repeatedly go back to Europe. And we did seven tours of Japan and been in, we played China. We went to Russia. We went to Poland. It's been, we always had to go to big enough places that could bring in a concert, a symphony orchestra, full symphony orchestra. So we didn't go to the littler places often. But been on the beach in Rio, on the wall in China, in the Kremlin, in Red Square. It's what do they say, that the way to learn about the world, at least for me, is to go see it if you can. And, there's a lot of ways to not have to go there, but going there was my education that I can never underestimate.
I only ever traveled as a solo musician, so I don't know, maybe it's different in an orchestra. I mean, you didn't dare do much in the way of sightseeing because you'd be so tired, afterwards at night.
On your job, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was a solo folk singer, so
everything was you. Yeah.
So everything was me. Is it different in an orchestra? Do you get to go and do you have that kind of time and energy to do things that are beyond just going and playing in the gig?
Well, sometimes we can lose focus of why we're on the road and use some energy on other activities. But I tried to do my best to make sure I knew, why I was there. But usually, you take a little nap in the afternoon and then you get a 6 o'clock bus to the hall and get your tails on, the white tie, and play your 2-hour show and then go find some dinner in Paris or, Tokyo, wherever we are. So while we often did one-nighters, to me, I was never feeling like, "Oh, poor me, I just had a night in Paris." I just had a night in Amsterdam. Shucks, I wish I could. I mean, certainly you would like to stay longer, but the experiences were just magnificent. And the thing about a symphony orchestra is, I think it's the same as you, is it's a soundscape. And in the soundscape, we're all participating. And for you, it's a solo soundscape, but it's still the soundscape. So, my job as a tuba player, I think, is every bit as important as anybody else that's participating in that soundscape. So I definitely, the tuba in a symphony orchestra is an amazing thing. Y'all may know there's only one typically. And every note the tuba player plays is either heard or felt. There's not a second, I don't think, where the tuba can just go, I'll just, you know, lay back and nobody's going to know I'm here. And so it's a wonderfully important part of the symphony orchestra, and I love the role, a tremendously important role, and challenging because it's just you. It's not like, which one of those basses did that? It's like, it's the tuba.
Well, you've had some exposure to rock and roll touring. How does that compare with classical touring? I worked on the rock and roll side, and I know it can be kind of crazy. Does it get crazy on the road with the orchestra?
You know, musicians are still musicians, and we had some great times for sure. I never did, you know, like Henry Rollins or whoever, get in the van. I never did one of those unless it was just a night to Houston or Dallas or something like that and back. So my touring has always been pretty privileged. In the Pittsburgh Symphony, we would be staying in, you know, among the best hotels in town. And of course, we're playing in among the greatest orchestra halls of the world. And by the time I joined the Pittsburgh Symphony in 1981, the union had gotten wonderfully strong in American symphony orchestras and also Canadian as a part of the American Federation of Musicians. And so they had made sure they couldn't, like, you know, drive us around the world and make us play a concert on the same day, you know, that we would have to have rest days with travel days and, you know, certain stuff. So the union wasn't trying for anything that we didn't need, because, you know, resting and being prepared for those kind of things. We had one time when we played in Dublin, Ireland, and I had gone into a bookstore and found Rocky's lyric book, my brother Rocky Erickson's lyric book. And it turned out the bookstore owner was a fan of Rocky's. And then he came to the concert that night with a friend of his. So afterwards, we went to the Irish pub and, you know, that kind of stuff. And the next day, my plan was just to get to Edinburgh, Scotland, and sleep all afternoon. But we got to the airport in Dublin, and the plane was delayed by hours. So there's no nap in the airport. Got to Edinburgh, had just the tiniest little nap. Got to the concert hall. Our concert's going to be broadcast in the United Kingdom, the whole United Kingdom, live. And we have a little, like, rehearsal to check out the sounds for the broadcast. And the conductor wants to start a tuba solo, and I missed the first note. And but, you know, we got to the broadcast, got to concert time, and I had a chance to get a little clearer. But, the adventures of the road are incredible. And playing in the concert hall in Paris, where The Rite of Spring of Stravinsky was premiered, and they rioted. So, you know, just so many great experiences.
Are there any classical groupies?
I mean, yes. Yeah, for sure. I would say probably particularly in Japan, Europe as well. But it's everywhere in the world that I went, when people knew that I was there for music, I always felt like I got some respect and some, you know, some reverence for what we were there doing. It's amazing how enthusiastic. In the 80s, we were in Japan, and it was, you know, people showing up with autographs, you know, asking for the programs and things. And then we have this reception in the American ambassador's home, which is near our hotel. And then the next night we have a reception in the hotel with like a 6 foot tall ice violinist, like ice sculpture violinist sitting on the table, you know. So we had a lot of grand experiences and a lot of incredible times with the people, you know, the best as possible to try to meet the public and, yeah, have those experiences. It couldn't be, you know. Anyway, I was just enormously blessed to have it, and I did my best to make sure my mind and my heart and my soul and my spirit was always open and always trying to take it in. Some people can get jaded quickly or slowly, and I did my best to just keep my love of music and what I was doing as on as possible so that I could benefit from it while I was there.
How was it working with Andre Previn?
Amazing. Amazing. It's just that's part of a story that is, you know, I mean, so much I'm blessed that it's kind of unbelievable to have this. But my dad, his favorite piece of music was Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin. And then one of his favorite performers recording the Rhapsody in Blue was Andre Previn at that time with the London Symphony Orchestra. And so then I'm getting to be 22 years old, and I get to present to my father my recording with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with Andre Previn conducting and playing George Gershwin. You know, I mean, that was just amazing to get to give my father a recording of his favorite piece by one of his favorite all-time composers and performers. And Previn was, he was just, he was slick for one thing. I mean, he was just cool, and he was so smart. You knew that he was one of the smartest people around in the room. And also his experience was just enormous. And, you know, he'd spent the 50s Hollywood writing hit movies, and the 60s being downbeat jazz musician of the year, playing his piano. And to get to hear him play piano was amazing. His Mozart was incredible. He even wrote a brass quintet for, not for the Pittsburgh Symphony, but at that time when we were there. So we got to play some chamber music concerts where he was on the same concert, and then we played his quintet, and then later he performed. I didn't get to play chamber music with him personally, but he was just a very inspiring person, and as down to earth as you can be when your former wife was Mia Farrow. And we would go play Avery Fisher Hall, and then there would be Mia and Woody Allen would be there in a flak jacket at the hall. And so, you know, there's generally some celebrity around Previn.
Well, that sounds great. So you mentioned that, you know, Previn had played more than one kind of music, and I know that you've played more. You haven't just played classical. So what are the challenges of shifting gears to other kinds of music? I know that you have some recordings as in your own name and with the Texcentrics and so forth. Is it hard to shift from playing classical music for all those years to playing other forms?
Well, I had started my study of popular music before the classical, being that my brother Rocky was 15 when I was born. By the time I'm two or three, he's teaching me Secret Agent Man on the guitar and Tambourine Man. And I remember my mom had me in guitar lessons for a short period of time. Unfortunately, there was not a piano teacher kind of in the network that could teach me, so I never learned how to play piano. But I was always exposed to popular music. Here in the 13th floor elevators as a little boy was quite the influence, my brother's band. And so to me, it's all music. I don't think of one or the other. And I remember getting to play with the very young Wynton Marsalis. And when I went, Wynton had just won a Grammy in classical and jazz in the same year, and he's playing with us in Pittsburgh. And when I met him, he's like, "Oh man, you gave us all inspiration at Juilliard because you won that job." And they put up the story at the on the bulletin board, and we were all looking at this. And of course, that was amazing to think that, you know, I gave a moment of inspiration to Wynton Marsalis. But he was at that time, he was going, "Well, I'm not sure I want to play jazz. I mean, I want to play classical because it takes a certain this or that, as opposed to me playing jazz." And I don't think so. I really don't think so. And not to question what he was doing in his decision making at the time to decide not to be a touring trumpeter on the classical repertoire, and coming from his family, you can see why he would favor jazz maybe, But to me, it's just all music. And that's one reason why I wanted to write this book, because when I was a young person, at age 12, they hand me a tuba and then they just say, express yourself. And they could have handed me a violin or a guitar or a drum or anything, but the words express yourself did not give me too many clues to run with. I tried, but so the reason I wrote the book is to hopefully give people an easy three-step process to go into the zone, get into the flow state, which is optimal for us humans, and make sure we know why we're there in the category of music. And whether it's punk rock or whether it's classical Bach, to me, it's all the same. It's got to be, foundational in the same way.
You know, it's interesting because one of my friends used to do sound. He used to own a studio, a small recording studio in the Bay Area. And he married a jazz flautist. And he said one of the things that really struck him about jazz musicians as opposed to folk musicians, who he'd recorded quite a lot of, was how well they knew their instruments and how much they knew how to get the best out of their instruments. And I mean, is that also true of classical musicians, do you think? Or is it special to jazz?
Your phone seemed like it broke up a little, you or me, but you're comparing like folk musicians to jazz musicians and jazz people knowing their instruments better.
Well, a friend of mine who ran a recording studio, he recorded a lot of folk musicians and a lot of jazz musicians, and he was married to a jazz flautist. And so he, in that particular comparison, he thought that jazz musicians are much more expert on getting everything they can out of their instruments. And I wondered if you thought that was true and whether it also applies to classical musicians.
Probably. I mean, the classical musician to have a professional career, you got to do everything that is ever required of you. The tuba's repertoire includes 4 octaves because some of the music put into the tuba's folder is predecessors of the tuba, the ofoclide, the chimbasso. Sometimes those parts get put in there. The French tuba in C, which is a whole octave smaller than the concert bass tubas we play, that part gets put in. And if you want to work, you just say, okay, thank you, I'll do my best to accommodate this part. So in classical music, you probably need the skills of a ballerina or a gymnast or something, right? You got to be totally fluid with the instrument, but that's not necessarily going to know that to ensure that you actually know how to play music. And that's again why I wrote my book. But facility with our instrument is can't be overrated. And one thing I love about the title Actors of Sound that I didn't expect is that I've teaching some musicians who normally might not read music. And I said, how would it work for actors if they didn't learn how to read? So you might as well learn how to read in music. You might as well. It's having a facility with our instruments is a wonderful, huge gift. And my knowing is if you're not doing this with your facility and towards freedom and processing its ever expansion, it's going to be going like that, right? We can't just keep a thing.
In folk music, it can vary a lot because the thing that makes somebody successful doesn't have, it may be being virtuoso on an instrument, but it may not be. It may be that you're a good songwriter or that you connect well with audiences or one of a number of other things.
Yeah. Nice. And for me, when I write songs and I play a rhythm guitar to accompany my songs, I'm not trying to be to your point, I'm just playing some rhythm. There's a lot better rhythm guitar players out there, but it's my rhythm and my song and that thing. And if I want a lead player, I'll get a lead player doing that for me. But again, facility, I think, is always a nice invitation. I got to see Count Basie and Oscar Peterson play a duo show. And so Oscar was a famous, 4 million notes, and Count was famous for just one or two, and they were trading. And at one point, Oscar did his normal thing, and then the count went. I mean, the count, similarly, he basically played an Oscar Peterson style solo, just kind of like, I could if I wanted, but pink, 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 pink. It was an incredible thing to see those two live and to see Count go there, but then just come on back to his more choice, you know, more purposeful. Not to say Oscar wasn't purposeful, but Count was definitely a minimalist.
That would be amazing. I'm not a musician myself, but I'm a meditator. And I appreciated your book as someone who, you know, who does meditation. And I think your book, the way I sort of took your book is that it's about, well, we were talking about like getting the most out of your instrument. To me, it's sort of like the book is about getting the most out of the blend of you with your instrument. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Fortunately, I hope that my connectivity is not weak, because I'm sometimes breaking up a little on the question.
It's a little weak.
Oh, shoot. Sorry about that.
It's okay. It's coming through okay.
Okay. That's the thing you have a nightmare about when you get on a... It's my first podcast. Thanks for getting me on a podcast, and it's hard to show up.
Oh, man, I can't believe that. Yeah, Well, this is a great conversation, but what I had asked about was whether I'm talking about your book as a book kind of about meditation and kind of about how we interact with the rest of the world, really, and specifically how, as a musician, you work with your instrument and the relationship you get into with your instrument and how you work with it.
Yeah, exactly. When I was 15, I was playing on the tennis team in junior high and had to choose band in high school over tennis because the marching band were practiced at the same time as the tennis team. But my dad gave me a book called The Inner Game of Tennis, and it was not a tennis book. It was about the inner game.
I have that book.
It's a great book, yeah. And the Harvard coach, he coached in the Olympics, and that book has never left my consciousness. And unfortunately, I never asked my dad for the subsequent decades before he died, Dad, did you know it wasn't a tennis book? But no doubt that helped me in my tennis game, but also helped me in my life, including my music. And then, as I said, when I was 12, they hand me a tuba, say, express yourself. And I'm like, what does it mean in music to express yourself? And so I had this deep question. And you know, you can be a part of somebody where you feel like they're doing it, or you kind of know they're doing it. You feel engaged. And then you're like, well, how do I do that? And how do I be intentional about it? And then even regarding the sound, you talked about facilitating the sounds from the instrument. Every musical instrument has its ideal sound right in it. And then the question is, why isn't everybody getting ideal sounds if it's sitting there just waiting for us to invite out? You know, folk singers or punks or whatever, they might not want the ideal sound, and I accept that. But in the most acoustic traditional sense, the instrument wants what it wants, and we have to be clearly delivering it in a way that hopefully is going to be clearly representative of the music and taking it to the audience. So in my opinion, Plato, I know more about Plato than Plato. He said the beginning of wisdom is the definition of the term. And I had already been thinking about knowing we needed to know what music was. And informally, I've asked a whole bunch of people, and about 5% of the people kind of have an answer for me fairly readily. And I'm not trying to dumb it down or make it somehow, a caricature or piece of it. I'm trying to simplified into all of it. So if sound is a part of it, and we know that's true, I think clearly expression is. And when I was 12, if they'd have said express yourself with an emotion, then I'd have been like, oh, okay, well then how do I make sure I have that if that's really what I'm working to do? And then utilize the inner game, or what could be called in the zone or in the flow state where we're not fighting, we're not flighting, we're not freezing. We're actually in the optimal state for us, not only humanity, but all of life, and we're flowing. And for us humans, the flow state releases 5 feel-good chemicals from our body, endogenous feel-good chemicals. And then my question is, why does the body want us to feel good when we're in flow? It seems like the body wants us to be addicted to our optimal. And it shouldn't be a catch me if you can. Oh, well, I felt like I was in flow one day, but I had no idea how I got there and how we could get back. It can be intentional. You got to know what you're doing. That's why Plato's beginning of wisdom is the definition of the term. And then you also have to get out of your own way. So a meditative thought is a wonderful thing to practice and being still. And then like Tai Chi Chuan, that's moving meditation. We need to take our meditation, our calmness, our presence, our poise into activity.
I learned a new term in your book that I didn't know before, embouchure. Did I pronounce that correctly? Yeah. And I don't know, I was kind of getting, it sounds like you went through kind of an evolution of your ability to get that right. And another thing about the book that you kind of mentioned, and you didn't go into it a whole lot, was the Alexander technique. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the Alexander technique and how you incorporated that in what you were doing?
Well, fortunately, when I got in the Pittsburgh Symphony, there was an Alexander teacher at Duquesne University, and somebody mentioned her to me, and seemed like a no-brainer. The Alexander technique, Alexander, F.M. Alexander, was an Australian orator. And as a young man, he wanted to have a career in the theater, but he would lose his voice during his performances. And the conventional people of the day, the doctor said, well, rest your voice. So he'd rest his voice for a few days and then lose it again in his show. And so he started to study himself with a whole bunch of mirrors and figure out how he was using his body in a way that was causing him to lose his voice. His work is about appropriate use of the self, is kind of a one way. You know, we want to be, what I like is the thought about just right. You know, the food was too hot, the food was too cold, the bed was too hard, the bed was too soft, just right, just right. That's the way the body wants to be used, and the Alexander technique can help call our attention to ways where we're not doing that and then guide us potentially to the ways where we are. There's another work called the Feldenkrais method. Moshe Feldenkrais was an Israeli physicist, martial artist, soccer guy, and he also got injured, and the conventional people couldn't help him. So he started looking at the movements of infants and young people going into toddlerhood and reasoned that if he could put himself back into those kind of movements that we did naturally upon our first years of life, that would help him re-emerge into his fluidity. And he was right. The Feldenkrais method is also an incredible, incredible work. And then I started studying Tai Chi Chuan in 1989 and, learned quickly from one of my fellow students that you don't learn Tai Chi Chuan, you study Tai Chi Chuan. So I think it's true for music. We don't learn music. We study music. We devote our consciousness to it. So did that answer your question?
Yeah, you mentioned something that you were doing with the tuba and a way that you corrected it. You know what I'm referring to?
Okay. Yeah. So you're I appreciate what you're getting at. And so you mentioned the word embouchure. And when I was a young brass player, they told me about that word and how to make it. But what they never told me was that the whole class of instruments that we call brass instruments is called the labrazones. And I discovered that because I'm blessed to be a patent holder in the brass mouthpiece world, and my patent attorney wrote, "Brass players, commonly referred to as labrazones," and I almost rudely laughed at her, like, "What do you mean commonly referred to? Because I never heard that, and nobody I know talked about that for decades of my career." So, and frankly, I'm not sure I actually regarded it when that happened in 2017, 2018, when the patent was getting written and achieved. But for whatever reason, last fall, I think I was looking at my patent. The mouthpieces are in a pre-launch. And so, and I saw Labrazone and I looked it up and said, lip read, R-E-E-D, lip read. So if it's a lip reed, you know, reeds are soft. Reeds could be a blade of grass. Reeds could be some cane if it's bigger, whatever. And so you put a mouthpiece on it, and then you seal the potential of the labrazone to be activated with the air. Completely different from what I was taught for my entire career on the tuba. So after 50 years of doing it incorrectly, I'm finally learning how to play, but I'm not playing a tuba. I'm playing a tuba, but it's a labrazone in the shape of a tuba. And this is, to me, if I'm giving anybody anything any good with this book, to the brass world and the music world in general, if just the thought of labrazone can get into the consciousness, because people are trying to make it into some place right in the middle. This is a sphincter, and the sphincter is designed to be closed, and the sphincter is designed to be relaxed. And so, but they wanted us to make it into something, which if you think of lip read, it's not that. So I get questions now from students. What about this? What about that? You know, sorry, I'm probably making funny faces. And I'm like, how's it freeing your labrazones? And for me, I can't really predict the future, but I know I said in my book that I believe my best playing days were ahead of me. And before I got labrazone and had been pulling away a lot of manipulation I had been taught over the years, I wasn't maybe convinced I could be successful at getting through this experience. But the labrazone works about 99.9% more full of ease than the tuba does. Amazing.
You mentioned remote control quite a bit throughout the book. Can you kind of explain how that concept works in your use of the term?
Yeah. So, you know, having a discussion with people about music and then saying, oh, you know, emotions and sound, most people outside of music, they'll be like, well, duh, Sumner, of course, that's what music, what else would it be? But then if you want to talk about an inner game of something or Zen or Taoism or Buddhism or whatever, people look at me sideways. And I've been trying to have that conversation since I was 15 and my dad gave me that book. So when I got to Chicago, I was studying privately there while I was in the Pittsburgh Symphony. And I told the trombonist of the Chicago Symphony, Edward Kleinhammer, he was a bass trombone there 46 years and he'd retired. And I was studying with him and he goes, well, if you like that book, The Inner Game of Tennis, he said, you're going to like Zen and the Art of Archery. So at that time, I didn't know that The Inner Game was a Western interpretation of Zen. I didn't know. But yes, I did like Zen and the Art of Archery. It's about a 70-page book that was the longest I had ever read because I couldn't even begin to hardly comprehend what it was saying, even though I had been studying The Inner Game. So then that just kept me interested in how can I allow my presence to be doing its thing and not be in its way. And, you know, what I love is there's a lot of popular applications and discussions of this, and famously in Star Wars, the Force. And you can't make the Force. You can only get out of the way of the Force and utilize the Force and allow the Force. And when you do, or you come from what I like to call remote control, then the potential is, but you can only do it intentionally. So that's why you got to know the definition of what you're doing. So you have to be intentional about what you're doing in order to get into the flow state. And then The nice thing about remote control is you can contrast it hopefully easily with direct control. You can ask yourself, was that remote control or was it direct control? And if I'm trying to make my lips into something they're not wanting to be, trying to push the fingers, trying to, whatever, that's direct control. And that's part of life, but we do best in flow, and we're not best we can fighting or freezing.
I've listened to and read a lot of musicians talking about their process of how they create their music. And you used a term early in the book that I hadn't heard from people like that. You used joy as an important part of your process. How do you get joy?
Well, thank you. Thank you. So if the premise of the definition of music being emotions and sound, then the question can be, well, what emotion? And I understand there's like four basic emotions: anger, sadness, grief, and joy. I saw it on the internet, must be right. And so when we're in anger and when we're in sadness, when we're in grief, keep moving. It's part of life. Keep moving. But when we're in joy, you might want to just camp out there. And it turns out joy is the strongest emotion that we could embody. So, and I believe that I can embody joy and still play you a sad song. So I don't have to match the emotion. I don't have to feel sad to play sad. So then the question is, well, how do you turn it on? How do we know we have it? And so then you can just hopefully find an occasion in your memory where you were having a whoopty time. And, you know, you're full of joy. You're like, wow, it's a birthday. It's a Christmas. It's a soccer game with a friend, playing music with somebody, so that you can go, okay, I can go to the days my sons were born. And I could just start to feel that feeling. And then if I buy into my own premise that joy in the sound is why I'm here, then I have to keep conjuring that feeling to make sure that I'm being proactive about delivering it. And then I just have to be listening to the instrument because it's getting me feedback moment by moment.
I always think of you as a joyful person, for sure. Are there, I mean, there's a lot of quotes in your book from various sources. Are there one or two particular quotes that you find most powerful that you think about most out of all of those?
Well, my last boss in the Pittsburgh Symphony was a man named Marsh Janssens, who was born and raised in Latvia, and English wasn't his first language. And he used to say, music includes technique. Technique does not include music. And there's kind of a stereotype about some, like, maybe Eastern orchestras where maybe their technique wasn't as good as some Western orchestras, but they had a lot of soul. And then you had Western orchestras that had amazing technique, but no soul. And so clearly this guy from Latvia, whose daddy had conducted the Leningrad Philharmonic, didn't think the Pittsburgh Symphony had enough soul. And he kept telling us over and over again, music includes technique. Technique does not include music. So that to me is the summation of the book, because when we're there for music, for our joy and our sound, as I think a way in, and we do that via our remote control, the technique comes in to serve it. Yeah, that's why we have to be intentional about it. And a faulty technique can't really come in to serve it. It has to be a free-flowing technique used correctly. But that's when you get into this flow state where you just kind of hardly even know what how it's happening. And then for me, that's where it has to invite humility. Because if all I did was just get out of my own way in these moments, how can I be like, oh, look what I just achieved. So that would be getting in my own way.
Well, I read in your book, something that really, I had to go and highlight it because it really struck me. It's, you say, or you wrote, I wish musical instruments would draw a tiny little drop of blood whenever we're not respecting their needs.
A little scoop. And thank you for bringing that up. And right near that, I say, I hope you hear this with as much love and respect. And, you know, I try to soften it as much as possible, but you know, my question is, when people ask, how do you get the instrument to sound the way it's designed to sound? I like to refer to how do you get a cat to purr? And I didn't grow up with cats. I grew up with dogs. So I'm now familiar with cats, fortunately. But before I was, I went to a friend's house and she was in her bedroom getting ready. And I'm sitting in her living room and her cat was there sitting on the couch with me. And I started to pet the cat in a way I thought was being nice to it. And then I had a bloody hand. I mean, just a little, you know. So, and I thought I was being nice to the cat. And so we know that a cat only wants what a cat wants in order for it to choose to purr or allow the purring. And it has to be the same thing for a musical instrument. The musical instrument only wants the match that it wants. It doesn't want more of a excitement for its acoustical needs or less of excitement. It wants a match. And so my joke was there is if only the needs of the instruments would be so highly regarded that if we did get out of match there, we'd have a little a little drop of blood. For me as a brass player, brass players are often sort of overblown, so they're not being used in a way where the instruments, in my opinion, it's singing out its happiness. And so maybe that's some of my bias towards people not making sounds that match the potential of the instrument. But yeah, I think we'd have a better sounding world if it were just one little drop every time. Maybe not every time, because we're humans. We're going to get out of relationship with our instrument. But again, the instruments, every instrument is designed with its best sound in it. And then the question is, why isn't everybody getting their best sounds? And I think some of it is just the lack of the curiosity to be digging into that thought. A lot of people have told me, well, how am I going to know? And the good news is the feedback is there instantly. It's the sounds.
That makes me think about how many musicians I've seen who have such well-worn instruments with them. You know, you can tell that they've been just playing them for years. And, you know, you can kind of imagine that they're in kind of a relationship with that instrument.
Yes, yes. And what I hope I'm doing with this book is when I was a kid and I beat over 100 people when I'm 18, but won the Pittsburgh Symphony, I was unconsciously competent. They gave me a big job so that there was some kind of, you know, check mark. I was competent, but I had no clue how I was competent or why. I hope that my book can take us into knowing how to be competent in particularly this avenue of music, but in life, if we, you know, make sure we're intentional about doing the activity clearly that we're doing. But to be a conscious competent is clearly the best way we want to keep growing through the life. And to your point, my oldest tuba is a 1974 handmade Swiss tuba. The company's name exists now, but the people don't exist. Peter Hirschbrunner Sr. made my tuba handmade and doesn't exist anymore. So, but yeah, so the instruments can be incredibly precious to us. And
how many tubas do you have? You said your oldest tuba. So presumably you have quite more than one.
Well, only two now. And the youngest is 1981 and I bought it when I got in the Pittsburgh Symphony. So these tubas have traveled.
Like I have friends who have, you know, dozens of guitars and I've never understood the point of that. It always seemed to me that if you found the one that was right for the sound you wanted to make, why would you need more of them? You know, unless you wanted to have a backup, but you know, I'm sort of bewildered by it. You know, one of my friends got to the point where he decided he had to write a business plan for every new guitar he bought.
Yeah, I can't answer that question. But in the tuba world, we have like bigger contrabass tubas, and then we have bass tubas, which is a medium, still large tuba.
Like having a 6-string guitar and a 12-string guitar, they have a different sound.
Yeah, or a bass guitar and a tenor
guitar.
Yeah,
or a baritone guitar. I understand. But it's having like multiple of the same category of guitar that I'm confused by.
Yeah, I guess that'd be luxury.
Either that or a fetish.
Yeah, I've seen performances where people, you know, have multiple guitars handed to them throughout the performance. And often there's differences in the guitars that are obvious, but sometimes they seem very similar.
I think sometimes it's because they use different tunings and they don't like retuning on stage, whereas I'm a master retuner and I don't care. You know,
that makes sense.
I can retune 2/3 of a guitar between songs and not have people notice. But a lot of people can't do that.
The Grateful Dead would have loved you because their tuning usually took extreme amounts of time. Hours.
There was a friend of mine who was a great banjo and guitar player who's dead now, and he was notorious for how long he took tuning his instruments. It was part of his show.
Well, Wendy, I'm sorry that my people didn't get you an advanced copy of the book over there across the pond, because I know that you are the one that has participated in music the most in this group here, and sorry I didn't get a chance to get you that and get your
I still have the copy, and I'll send it to you, Wendy.
Okay.
Give me your address.
It's a very different experience, though, being a solo folk singer. You know, like, you know, you were talking about travel days and rest days, and I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, I tried not to drive more than 300 miles and do a gig the same night. You know, I mean, it's just not the same world at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, to do that, I mean, youth can be on our side and we can get away with a bunch of stuff, you know, when we're younger, but driving and playing your concert and being responsible probably for the merch and all the other stuff. Once I left the Pittsburgh Symphony and I started pursuing my singing and songwriting more, I relished going into the Hole in Wall here in Austin and setting up the mailing list and setting up once I had a disc set. So it was a joyfully part of the experience, but certainly it's easier when we have drivers and managers and merch people and publishing people. And
yeah, one of my friends who's been on the road for 50 odd years solved this by marrying somebody who was willing to travel with him.
Nice. Yeah, it reminds me hearing Chuck Mangione at the Paramount Theater here in Austin when I was in the 70s and I was in my teens, and Daddy was selling merch for him in the lobby. You know, Pap Mangione, I think. Pap. I can't remember his name.
This raises the question, what are you doing now?
Well, good question. I have started my professional teaching career in 1981, same year I started in the Pittsburgh Symphony. So I'm so glad to now be 44 years into teaching and have my book and hopefully never be another day without it, because I feel blessed to now have this to shepherd into the world. I hope it's meaningful to people. The mouthpieces I'm launching this year, in the last quarter here, which real soon, Unified Performance is my mouthpiece company. And what we're doing is taking the rim width of the French horns that was acceptable 250 years ago when the French horn came into existence, and giving it to all the other brass instruments, because no one could tell me why the trumpet, trombone, tuba have fatter rims than the French horn. And so I'm trying to give them the same benefit to that. So I'm working on the mouthpiece company. I'm writing some children's songs. My book is blessedly dedicated to my sons. I'm daddy of a 7 and 4-year-old sons, and wonderful inspiration for writing children's songs. Never imagined I would want to do that, but now I want to not want to. I'm writing. It's going to be a little. I think it'll be a little show, a little life show for kids. Hopefully, with great melodies and great words, and not talking down to them, but giving us some, you know, kernels of truth that hopefully can help us all as we go. And then also, way back in the beginning, 2000 something, and my oldest brother Rocky hadn't been performing, and people asked me to do his songs, so the 13 Foot Elevators, and I did several of those, and people said they liked those experiences. And then fortunately my brother returned to performing, and so I said, well, Rocky, those are your song, I don't need to do them. But now, unfortunately, he's still dead after 6 years. And so I've been playing some concerts, bringing his songs to people since he's not here to do it. And I'm kind of the only sibling that could or maybe would want to. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. And
wow, it's been 6 years, huh?
Yeah, it's been 6 years, May 31st. People have said, well, what's it like losing Rocky? And then my answer is, what's it like for you? You know, so many people like, I hear his music every day. I think of him all the time. And I'm like, yeah.
So as we're getting close to the end, since we're talking about Rocky, you were, I mean, I remember seeing You're Gonna Miss Me, the documentary, and you had a key role then, and that was a lot of that was about the things that happened that helped Rocky return to performing, right? And you were very involved in that. And do you want to say a little bit about how you worked with Rocky to help him kind of get it back together to get back on stage?
Well, I remember Henry Rollins had published Rocky's second lyric book in the 90s, and he told me, he said, I think Rocky's ready for good things. And so I just took that to heart. And Bill Bentley at Warner Brothers Records in the 90s said Rocky was the most tragic figure in the history of rock and roll. And I had been chronically depressed about my oldest brother since I was a little boy and visiting him at Rush State Hospital for the criminally insane. I didn't know how depressed I was because it was just a chronic state. And so when I got to a moment where I thought I could help Rocky, I think Providence moved, and Rocky indeed wanted good things for himself. And the funny thing, Clementine Hall, she says, you can't get Rocky to do anything he wouldn't want to do. So, you know, some people would think, oh, I did something and made Rocky did something. No. Rocky only did what he wanted to do. Unfortunately, he chose an incredible wellness journey that I laid out for him, but he didn't resist it. And then when Rolling Stone around 2005 said he was the most improbable comeback in the history of rock and roll. And I like to pair that with Bill Bentley's earlier, you know, the most tragic figure in the history of rock and roll. It was great that he had that comeback. And when I found out how depressed I was about Rocky from childhood was when the depression lifted and he'd gotten better. And so it was a win-win for everybody involved.
Yeah, I want to tell you how much I admire your part in that. I mean, Rocky and I had crossed paths over the years from time to time. And the last time I saw him, which was not too long before he passed away, he was just as happy as a clam. I've never seen anybody happier than he was. And you know, I think you had a lot to do with that.
Well, you know, with him being 15 years older than me, I remember one day, a Saturday morning, and he came back home from wherever he was, and he had these pretty far out pair of pants on for the day. They were striped green, purple, blue, not loud, 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 but loud enough for the 60s. And he had a little tiny pair just like them for me. And I felt like I was like a member of the band, you know. I mean, there he is giving me the same. And we have a picture subsequently of him and I both wearing those pants when I visited him at Rush State Hospital for the criminally insane. But I always felt there was a Rocky Sumner connection. I just felt like there was just a thing. And Rocky never told me that he wanted me to help him. And it turned out that he had expressed that to the documentarian on film, but Kevin, it missed him when it happened, and he couldn't come to me and say, oh, by the way, Rocky said he wants to get better. So I had to just go on faith that there was a Rocky Sumner connection somehow that was going to be for good, and that Henry Rollins's words that Rocky wanted good things in his life were true. And then Henry ended up buying his hero's dental work. So what an amazing thing. I was with Henry after he did a spoken word in Pittsburgh, and I said, "Hey, man, you want to call Rocky?" And we got on the phone, and Henry did the most natural thing, but I'm standing next to him, and it just sounded like, whoa. Henry said, "Hey, Rocky, how you like your teeth?" Be like, if I gave you that shirt, hey, John, how do you like your shirt, man? And it was a soulful, beautiful moment, and I'm grateful that Henry stepped up to do that for his hero, Rocky. And Rocky was my hero, too, but, you know, I'm not it wasn't because he was a great musician or a public figure that, you know, I adored my big brother. It was those things, you know, included, of course, because I love his music. But his spirit was just so peaceful and settling, and you never knew what was going to come out of his mouth, and so he was totally unpredictable. And I mean, I can tell you a million one stories. So I was trying to do the business of the tech-centrics appropriately, and so I didn't tell anybody that I had this name, the tech-centrics, until I had blah blah some business things in place. So I was in the car with Rocky. I'm like, hey Rocky, you want to know what my band name is? And, you know, I think I'm going to bring something out for my big brother. And before I can say it, he goes, 100 Texas Monkeys. And, you know, there's a monkey lore, monkey, you know, escape monkeys in South Texas is some of our lore. Maybe it's true. But I had also discussed the 100th Monkey book with Rocky about, you know, abolishing nuclear weapons and, you know, consciousness reaching a certain level. So I'm getting ready to say, hey, I got a band, we're going to call ourselves the Tech-centrics. And he popped out, 100 Texas Monkeys. And I'm like, okay, brother, thank you, I love you, you're a genius.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Sumner. This has been a great conversation, and I really enjoyed and appreciate the book.
But it's an honor and a privilege, and I hope the book can bring some kind of value and benefit to you and everyone that it brings. I'm hoping to leave a legacy you know, like in campfire or campsite, right? Leave the campsite better than you found it. I'm trying to leave this world better than I found it. And so appreciate y'all also doing the same. Didn't get to speak much to the inspiring work that I've learn that you guys have been doing. So thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be here today.
Thank you.
Thanks. We appreciate you coming back, and you have to come back.
I'd love it.
Yeah, please do. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.